Any preliminary questions? Okay. Seems like a while since we've been thinking about causation, but let's sort of try to reconstitute where we were when we left the subject. We were talking about Sindel, and Sindel gives a kind of overview of the variety of different ways that a plaintiff can go about getting an exception to the ordinary rule of establishing but-for causation, specifically identifying the defendant who caused the plaintiff's injury. And as we saw, the plaintiff unsuccessfully tried alternative liability, concert of action, enterprise liability, and was finally allowed to proceed on a market share liability theory. I think I mentioned last time sort of the transition between Sindel and its sequel, Sindel 2.0, as it were, Brown versus Superior Court on page 29. And as I think I said, there are two issues worthy of our attention in Brown versus Superior Court. One we will postpone until Chapter 9. That is the issue of the standard to which we hold the drug manufacturers. So the product liability issues about whether we impose strict liability for what turns out to be a defective product, or whether manufacturers of prescription drugs like DES should be held to a different standard. Again, we'll postpone that discussion. The other issue in Brown versus Superior Court is exactly how will this market share liability be imposed? And the first thing to observe is that market share liability requires us to make pretty difficult assessments of what market share to assign to each defendant. And what makes it difficult is knowing the reference point in an individual case, so that if, for example, Judith Sindel had been in Spokane, or at least her mother had been in Spokane when her mother was taking this drug, how do you establish the market share of different manufacturers for that particular incident? Would you look at the quantity of DES that was sold in Eastern Washington or in Spokane in particular? Suppose Judith Sindel's mother can recall some detail about the purchase of this product. Suppose, for example, that she went to Safeway to get all of her prescriptions filled. Would we look at the market share for Safeway stores, assuming we could find such information? Suppose she has some memory of how she took the drug, whether it's in the form of a pill or a syrup or some other delivery method. Does that change our analysis of the market share? It could change it quite dramatically. Suppose, for example, one manufacturer sold DES only in pill form, and she remembers taking it in the form of a kind of syrup. Does that mean that that manufacturer is entitled to be dismissed from the lawsuit? What if a manufacturer shows that most of their sales were directly to hospitals and very little of the product they sold went to retail pharmacies? Again, you can imagine weeks of trial devoted solely to the battle over how you calculate market share in any particular instance. But let's assume we've somehow solved those problems, and we have a determination of the market share to be assigned to the variety of different manufacturers. And again, imagining this to be a kind of pie chart, if we divide it up into a variety of different market shares, let's say manufacturer A has 10% of the market, manufacturer B has 20% of the market, manufacturer C has 5% of the market, and so on, exactly how will the liability be assigned? Now, the plaintiff asks in Brown versus Superior Court to have each manufacturer who could be liable for the, or could have sold the drug to the plaintiff's mother, each manufacturer be held liable for all of the plaintiff's damages. This is, again, the idea of joint and several liability. And as I've said before, I don't want to borrow too much trouble of the kind that we'll get into in Chapter 6 in figuring out how jurisdictions, particularly in various forms of tort reform, have modified the rule of joint and several liability, replaced it with some kind of individual liability. But again, the plaintiff would prefer joint and several liability for each of the defendants. In the alternative, the plaintiff suggests that such defendants as are able to be brought into court, let's suppose it turns out to be 70% of the market, the other 30% is bankrupt or otherwise not available to be held liable for the injury. The plaintiff says, why don't you take that share of the market represented by the defendants in court and basically sort of expand everybody's liability proportionately so that in the end each manufacturer pays enough so the plaintiff gets a full recovery. Alternatively, the defendants argue that the liability should be limited to their percentage shares, such that each defendant pays whatever the court determines to be, in effect, the percentage likelihood that in any individual case it was that manufacturer's drug that caused the plaintiff's injury. Well, the court wrestles with this, and at the end they decide that they're going to impose only individual liability so that each one is liable for their percentage share and no more. And notice that the court is, as it did in Sindel 1.0, is making policy here. They're determining the scope of liability. And in effect, one of the things the court says is, well, gee, we gave a break to the plaintiff by allowing this theory in the first place. Turnaround is fair play. Now we're going to limit the plaintiff's ability to recover from the defendant to whatever that defendant's market share is determined to be. The court giveth and the court taketh away. Blessed be the name of the court. So again, you're in an area where, to some extent, the rules are being made up as we go along, and again, you have to be prepared as a litigant for things to kind of bounce along. We'll see that additionally in the next case, where the court is trying to figure out how to handle different kinds of proposed market share liability cases and figuring out how wide to cast the net of liability, at the same time how to make appropriate limitations so that the tort system doesn't reach beyond what it can fairly handle. Questions about Brown versus Superior Court at this point or the court's determination? Okay, well then let's move on and look at this lease case, Edwards versus A.L. Lease and Company. Again, another attempt by the plaintiff to avoid the difficulties of identifying which defendant caused the plaintiff's injury, but we'll see how the court chooses to handle that situation. Can somebody tell us about lease? Whatever you do under the lease of my brethren here. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Okay, and so the plaintiffs again are saying we're stuck identifying who sold this, but we can tell you in the aggregate these are the kinds of people who manufactured or distributed the, not manufactured but distributed the pipe, and we can identify their market shares, and when we figure that out, we think that liability should be imposed proportionally. What other kinds of cases had the court recognized in the past as appropriate for this kind of treatment? Okay, but there were the prior precedent of cases where, in addition to Sindel, and they of course distinguished Sindel here, that this case is not like Sindel in important respects. It's also not like other kinds of cases where they've permitted market share liability. What other kinds of cases have been treated with this market share liability theory? Okay. Well, that was actually an alternative liability theory. They make some reference to the asbestos cases where there is the division of trying to look here where they have that. I'm not able to put my finger on it at this moment, but there's reference to the there's a local court rule that deals with the asbestos cases permitting certain kinds of market share liability. In any event, so the court's trying to figure out, is this like the cases where we've allowed market share liability or is it not? How is it unlike Sindel? Okay. Okay, so we're seeing in some ways the same thinking that we saw in Rossellini's concurring opinion in Siegler, to say that this doctrine applies essentially when you have no other place to go, but if you have some other place to go, it really doesn't apply. Now, again, this is sort of a close case in which, as it turns out, you could find out who distributed this pipe, but it would require an enormous amount of effort to do so, and the plaintiffs don't want to go through that effort. But again, the court is weighing in this case the interest of the plaintiffs in finding some remedy for their injury, which the court is reasonably confident they have by way of the manufacturers. The additional liability of the people who distributed the pipe is something that could be handled through cross claims or other mechanisms whereby the liability could be further distributed. So again, in reading this opinion, you see the way the court is kind of tiptoeing through this area, saying, well, over here we allowed you a market share liability theory because it was the only way to solve a very serious problem, but over there, we're unpersuaded that market share liability is really required. And where we don't need it, we're going to avoid it. So, again, just as with Sindel, watching the court at times, in effect, favoring the plaintiff's interests, allowing some kind of remedy, at the same time, the court's reluctant to push the boundaries of the ordinary rules of causation, where there's less compelling justification. Okay, the end of this section basically has to do with, or this, I want to conclude this section bearing in mind what it is we were struggling with, what problem we are trying to solve, because as we move to the next section, loss of a chance, we have a very different kind of problem. And as in other areas of legal analysis, you first have to identify what problem you're trying to solve before you start rummaging through your bag of tools to see what legal doctrines you have that might address that problem. The problem we've had up to now is somebody caused the plaintiff's injury. We're reasonably confident that whoever caused it was negligent in doing so. We have a bunch of defendants who could have caused the injury, but we're having a tough time figuring out which one did the thing that caused this particular plaintiff's injury. And so we had all these different, you know, alternative liability, concert of action, enterprise liability, market share liability, each one applying under different circumstances for different kinds of policy reasons. But again, it was the inability to identify which defendant caused the injury that triggered our need for some kind of legal doctrine to help us out. As we switch to the next section, loss of a chance, we have a different sort of problem. It still falls under the heading of but-for causation and the exceptions to it, because we're looking at the plaintiff's burden of showing that the defendant's negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. And so when the plaintiff's having a tough time doing that, depending upon why they're having a tough time doing it, we may invoke one or more of these exceptions. So the case to just sort of get us thinking about the problem of loss of a chance is Dillon versus Twin State Gas and Electric. Somebody tell us about Dillon. Mr. Breck. Energized, as they say. Okay, and he's killed by the electrocution, and his family sues for wrongful death. And what happens at the trial of the case? Not exactly. What does the case report tell us about the result of the trial? Okay, and that's one of the things the court talks about on appeal, but just so we understand where we are procedurally, how did the trial end? Who's appealing this? What's the complaint on appeal? Ms. Fudge? What does that mean? What's your guess? Okay, and we refer to that as a hung jury. That is, they can't come down on one side or the other. They are up in the air, so to speak. Okay, so it turns out that makes sense in light of the subsequent argument. Apparently, the defendant. What's the cure or what's the remedy when the judge determines that the jury can't reach a verdict? What does the judge then do? What's the ordinary procedure after a jury has hopelessly deadlocked? Oh yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, the order, you got a new trial. I mean, again, trial judges often plead with juries, in effect. They have to be careful that they don't put too much pressure on juries. But there is a so-called dynamite charge where the trial judge tells the jury, in effect, please, you know, we've spent all this time. Can't you talk to one another and argue this out and come to some conclusion? And if they can't, then the trial judge says, okay, fine, we'll just have to retry this case. Now, the defendant appeals that order of a new trial, arguing what? Okay, there's part of the case is about whether or not there was negligence, whether or not the defendant owed any duty to these boys who were up trespassing, in effect, in a place where they shouldn't be. And that goes back sort of to our whole, you know, turntables, pools of sulfuric acid issue about, you know, children and playing and all that sort of stuff. But in addition to the negligence issue, there's another issue. Yeah. And you could imagine two scenarios from a fall, one being, but survives. And the other scenario, yeah. So if, in fact, the jury decides that but for the electrocution caused by this wire, the boy would have fallen and likely would have fallen to his death, what result? Right. You look at, you know, 32 feet per second acceleration, you know, and the amount of time it takes for a falling body, so to speak, to, you know, hit the water or hit the rocks. There's very little, if any, damage from the loss of those 6 seconds or whatever it would have taken between the time he actually died and the time he would have died if the defendants had used reasonable care. Alternatively, the jury might find that he, although he had a chance that he would have been killed, their conclusion is, more probably than not, he would have survived. Then what? The defendant would be liable for what kind of damages? Well, what we're trying to figure out is if the jury had found that it was probable he would have survived, although he would have survived in a badly injured condition, then how does the jury, or what does the jury do with that information? Well, then you'd have to figure out what's the difference between a life with a serious permanent injury and death. What damages were suffered by the fact that the boy was killed rather than survived with various kinds of impairments? And again, we'd be speculating as to what kinds of impairments this fall would have involved, but we'll take a lot of that up in Chapter 3 when we try to, you know, make some sense of the process of assigning damages to any particular case. The point is that there's some kind of recovery, whatever that is, as opposed to no recovery. And it operates essentially as like a light switch. You know, the light is either on or the light is off. By contrast, you could imagine getting information that would lead you to various kinds of probabilities. In this case, you could take some, you know, crash test dummies, and based upon the information about where the boy was at the time he fell, you could perform various kinds of experiments and see, okay, if you fall from this height, and we do this 100 times, 60 of those times he does suffer a fatal injury, but 40% of the time he lands in the water or he lands in some other place where he could have survived the injury. You have a 60-40 chance, 60% chance you're going to get killed, 40% chance you're going to survive. Under that scenario, again, the plaintiff is entitled to what? 60% chance he's going to die, 40% chance he's going to live. Plaintiff would be entitled to, well, as far as we know so far, the plaintiff would be entitled to nothing because the plaintiff has failed to meet the test that we require the plaintiff to show, which is more probably than not the plaintiff would have avoided injury but for the defendant's negligence. Even showing the plaintiff would have avoided the more serious injury, the plaintiff would have avoided being killed, the plaintiff would have survived, and what benefit we assign to surviving with serious injuries as opposed to being killed, whatever that is, if the plaintiff can't persuade us that more probably than not could have been avoided if the defendant had used reasonable care, if the plaintiff fails the test, the plaintiff gets nothing. By contrast, again, if through our experimentation we find out that 40% of the time he's killed but 60% of the time he survives, what does the plaintiff get then? Yeah, 100% of the damages, whatever we determine them to be. If the plaintiff meets the test, they get it all. That is, this differential between death and serious injury, whatever that is. By contrast, if the plaintiff falls short of that more probable than not standard, the plaintiff gets nothing. Again, like a light switch, traditional light switch, it either goes on or it goes off. We have no flexibility here to vary the award based upon our evaluation of the relative probability involved. Ms. Williams. Because we have Chapter 2, that again, the plaintiff's burden is to establish not only that the defendant was negligent. We could be satisfied to a moral certainty that the defendant is negligent, but the defendant won't have to pay for an injury even though the defendant's behavior was negligent, unless the plaintiff satisfies us that that negligence is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. So let's assume, for example, that I'm driving down the street at 37 miles an hour and the speed limit is 35 miles an hour, and a little kid darts out in front of my car and I run him over, and he's, you know, seriously injured or killed. And you say, as a matter of law, you were driving 37 in a 35 mile an hour zone, you were negligent. The plaintiff still has to satisfy us that the differential between 35 and 37 miles an hour made a difference. If I hadn't been speeding, what? I could have stopped in time. The kid wouldn't have been hit so hard. What's your theory here as to why my negligence caused the injury? So here again, the point is, yes, because we negligently allowed this line to be electrified, the boy was electrocuted. But if we hadn't done that, hadn't electrified the wire, then what? Would he have, if he would have died anyway, falling from that height, because our wire wasn't there, then where's the harm? Where's the connection between the negligence of the defendant and the injury that was suffered by the plaintiff? So that's what's going on here. Just so we're clear about what happens to this case, the court's ultimate determination is what? What do we need to do with this case at this point? Remember that it ended in a hung jury. The trial judge said, I'll order a new trial. And the defendant says, wait a minute, judge, you shouldn't order a new trial. It's clear that the plaintiff can't meet their burden of proof. The appellate court's answer to that claim of error, they essentially affirm the trial judge's order of a new trial. They say, this is a question for the jury. Defendant, you may be successful in persuading the next jury that the defendant's negligence in this case didn't make a difference, but you'll have to state your case to the jury. We can't say that as a matter of law. Now, I wanted to clarify the traditional rule, just so we have that as the background before we get into the more exotic, you know, efforts to try to introduce a more flexible rule. Let's make sure we understand what the baseline is here. And the baseline is, it's an all or nothing game. If the plaintiff meets the test, the plaintiff gets a full recovery. If the plaintiff fails the test, the plaintiff gets nothing. And in the next case, in Hardy, the plaintiff says, why are we so inflexible here? Isn't there room for some greater sophistication in the way we evaluate the plaintiff's claim? Ms. Ma? Well, no. What the way is, sort of going back to Mitchell versus Gonzalez, the way the jury gets instructed is essentially a kind of, you know, three-step process. Namely, it's the plaintiff's burden to establish negligence, assuming that's what we're talking about. Secondly, it's the plaintiff's burden to show that negligence was a proximate cause of the injury. And thirdly, it's the plaintiff's burden to establish the nature and extent of the plaintiff's damages. With respect to proximate cause, you'll remember the jury is told, here is how we define proximate cause. A proximate cause is one which, in a direct and unbroken sequence, or a natural and continuous sequence, some formula like that, a proximate cause is one which, in a natural and continuous sequence, produces the injury and without which the injury would not have occurred. So again, the burden there, and we're reminded that burden is imposed only by a preponderance of the evidence. All of the plaintiff's proof has to persuade us only to that extent, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but only by a preponderance of the evidence, but it still has to be by a preponderance of the evidence, that this is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Had the defendant in this case not put an electrified line right next to where the plaintiff was on this bridge, would he have avoided death? The jury might say yes. Seriously injured, but he would have avoided death. The jury might say no. We think that in all likelihood, or at least we would say more probably than not, that he would have been dead either way. That's their call. But it's based on that jury instruction. Obviously, the judge doesn't say, ladies and gentlemen, the jury is like a light switch. But the judge, in effect, gives them this only two alternatives. The defendant's liable, the defendant's not liable. Those are the two places we can go. Now, let's look at Hardy, because the plaintiff in Hardy wants a little more sophistication and says we shouldn't be confined to this inflexible, rigid test. Can somebody tell us about Hardy? Ms. Dobbins. Okay. And what was negligent about the phone company's activity here? Yeah, when he picked up the phone, they said, well, we can't get you to the hospital, but we can get you tickets to Garth Brooks. But that wasn't what he wanted. Okay, so again, we would have all these interesting Chapter 1 questions about, well, what is the standard of care, you know, learned hand calculus, you know, what's the probability of harm, and, you know, what's the custom of the industry, how expensive would it be to provide some kind of bypass system so that if you needed to call 911, you wouldn't have to stand in line behind the people trying to get Garth Brooks tickets. I don't know what the answer to that, but let's assume that the phone company was negligent in setting up a 911 system that people weren't able to access. Then what? What's our Chapter 2 issue here? Okay. Okay, or to put it the other way, whether reasonable care would have made a difference, whether the outcome would have been different if, when he picked up the phone and dialed 911, he'd gotten medical help. What do we know about the answer to that question? But what do we, if you ask the question, would it have made a difference if we had gotten through to 911, we have an answer to that question. What is our answer? Well, we actually know a little bit about that. That is, statistically speaking, if you have a heart attack like this woman's heart attack, and you call 911 and they bring the ambulance right away, what are your chances of survival? Well, that's true, but what are they? That's why you call the ambulance, after all, is because they make a difference, but they only make a difference to the extent that 40% of the people that get prompt treatment die anyway. So what we know from people with heart attacks is even with prompt treatment, most of them die anyway. So the defendant's argument, in effect, is, Where's the harm? Again, going back to our traditional test, if you can't show that with reasonable care the outcome probably would have been different, I'm sorry, plaintiff, but you failed the test. Had you, you know, gotten over that threshold of showing more probable than not, then you get a full recovery, but if you fall short of it, you get nothing. The plaintiff says it shouldn't be that rigid. And the plaintiff has a precedent where the courts elsewhere have said it's not that rigid. Where else has the plaintiff been given special treatment, so to speak? Okay, so if you go to the hospital, if this had occurred not while the guy's frantically calling 911 and getting no answer, but if this woman had been treated in the hospital and she had a condition where, with proper medical care, she had a 40% chance of survival, but they negligently failed to provide her with the proper treatment and she consequently died, in the medical arena, or, you know, if you're being treated by a hospital, they apply this doctrine called loss of chance. And how does that work? Well, that sounds like we would get a full recovery. In other words, more probably than not, the doctor's treatment was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. But suppose we're under the situation where we can't quite say that, but we can say, gee, going into this procedure, you had a 40% chance of recovery. Because the doctors acted negligently, you essentially lost that chance. What does the plaintiff get in the medical arena? Well, in the case of medical malpractice, we say the plaintiff gets that 40%, if you will, a sort of lottery ticket. Again, if you think about this in terms of traditional probabilities, suppose you have some Powerball lottery in which there are, you know, nine qualifying tickets, and these nine people will have a drawing to see which of them wins the grand prize. Eight of them will get nothing, or they get some consolation prize, but one of them will win $10 million. How much is one of those tickets worth? A 1 in 9 chance of winning $10 million. 11 point some million. It's worth $1.1 million. Investors, you know, depending on how much of a discount they want to take for, or how risk positive or risk averse they are, but if you've got a chance, you know, if you've got a lottery ticket that's got a 1 in 9 chance of paying out $10 million, you'll find people that'll pay you money for that. They'll certainly pay you, lots of people would pay you $1 million for that ticket, for a 1 in 9 chance of $10 million. If you keep playing those odds over and over again, you're going to make some money. So if the legal system is answering that lottery ticket is worthless because it's likely not going to pay out, again, the plaintiff in the medical malpractice context says that's not the way the real world works. In the real world, you get paid the value of that chance. So again, suppose you have one of these tickets and you entrust it to your friend, and your friend negligently loses it. Would you say, well, that's okay, probably wouldn't have paid out anyway? You would have said, you idiot, or words to that effect. You know, what were you, you know, why, that was my chance, that was worth a lot of money. Now, So the plaintiff says we did it in, you know, if this had happened in the hospital, it would be covered by the loss of a chance doctrine applied in the context of medical care. Let's do it when it applies to the 911 system. What's the court's answer to that invitation by the plaintiff? Why? Okay, as distinguished from a telephone company telephone subscriber relationship, why do we need it in the doctor-patient relationship, but we don't need it here? Okay, but why do we change the rules of causation? That is, if the doctor probably didn't cause whatever the bad result is, I go to the doctor, I've got a bad shoulder, there's a surgery that 30% of the time will restore, you know, the benefit of, you know, full motion, whatever it is. The surgery has a 30% chance of making a significant improvement, but 30% of the time, it doesn't, 70% of the time, it doesn't do anything for me. If the doctor negligently performs the procedure such that I gain no benefit from it, according to this doctrine, I'm entitled to 30% of whatever the value of that improvement is, because the doctor's negligence took away this 30% chance. Now, it turns out, for some strange reason, the courts are afraid that if we didn't have this doctrine, what would doctors start doing? They'd go through their medical charts and find all the patients whose conditions had a less than 50% chance of survival, and they draw a little happy face next to that, meaning, doesn't matter what I do to this patient, they're probably going to have this bad result anyway. So they can't sue me. For some reason, the courts thought, gee, if we don't recognize loss of a chance, doctors are going to declare open season, in effect, on those patients that have a less than 50% chance of survival. And that's just rather far-fetched notion of how doctors are going to behave, but the court doesn't think that that applies to the phone company as it might to doctors. One major difference, of course, is that phone companies don't have statistics on outcomes the way physicians have statistics on outcomes. So that if you come to a doctor with a particular kind of tumor, let's say, we have very good medical data on the likelihood that that tumor is going to result in, you know, fatal injury or various kinds of complications. We can tell you, based on your condition, with that condition you've got a 60% chance of survival or a 20% chance of survival or a 90% chance of survival. Few other areas in life lend themselves to that kind of statistical comparison. Certainly the phone company is not in a situation to look at the calls coming in saying, ah, that guy's calling 911 because he's got a wife with a heart attack. She's probably going to die anyway. Don't worry about it. Sell some more Garth Brooks tickets. That's not going to happen. But I'm not sure the fantasy they have about doctors is a reliable fantasy either, but that is in part what motivated the court to adopt this rule in the medical malpractice context. Long and short of it here on loss of a chance is the courts have applied this doctrine in limited circumstances in the medical malpractice arena in response to the perception that failing to provide some kind of remedy is unfair to the plaintiff. The flip side, of course, is that arguably it's unfair to the defendant that when the plaintiff meets the test, they get 100%. When they fail the test, they can ask for this percentage allocation. Sauce for the goose arguably should be sauce for the gander. But we'll have to leave it at that and pick it up again tomorrow.